Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of April. This hour, we will be talking about Margaret Thatcher, who, of course, died this week, the first woman to become Prime Minister of Britain and the first to lead a major Western power in modern times. She led her Conservative Party to three straight election victories and held office for 11 and one half years, from May of 1979 to November of 1990, longer than any British politician in the 20th century. So her life is well worth our examination. And we have a wonderful guest with us this hour. Our guest is Nicholas Wapshot. He's an author, journalist, and broadcaster, is now an online content consultant. He was previously senior editor at the Daily Beast and also was the New York bureau chief of the Times of London, editor of the Saturday edition of the Times of London, business columnist for the Sunday Telegraph, and he was a political editor of The Observer, covered Margaret Thatcher's final years in office. In 1983, he wrote one of the first biographies of Thatcher, and he's written widely about conservative and libertarian theology. He has broadcast on CNN, MSNBC, PBS, and Fox News, and he is also author of a book on Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and we thought we would concentrate a good part of the hour on that relationship, which is absolutely fascinating. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Nicholas. Here's how you reach us and him this hour, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Nicholas, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's a great pleasure.
You write about when Margaret Thatcher first met Ronald Reagan in April of 1975, she was 50, he was 65, but they bonded instantly. Why did that happen, Nicholas?
Well, the whole meeting came about rather unusually. Margaret Thatcher's husband, Dennis, who was a very important figure in her life and really provided the wherewithal for her to run her political career, he was also very interested in conservative ideas. He was just a regular businessman, really, but a successful one. And he had been to a meeting where the former governor of California, Ronald Reagan, was doing a tour giving talks. And he came back from this meeting and said to his wife, Margaret, you should listen to this fellow, Ronald Reagan. He talks exactly like you. And she made arrangements for Ronald Reagan's weekly Saturday radio broadcasts that he made of a conservative disposition for the transcripts to be sent to her on a regular basis. So when he was coming through London in 1975, she'd just been elected leader of the opposition, the Conservative Party, which is most unlikely, the Conservative Party being the most male chauvinist party of the two parties in Britain. And he went to see her in her office in the House of Commons. And this was a meeting scheduled for 5-10 minutes, and it went on for more than an hour. The assistants kept coming in saying, you know, you're backing up, you've got lots of other people to see. And she said, go away. She was so enjoying talking to Ronald Reagan. They just finished each other's sentences. I mean, they just thought identically. They'd read the same books, you know. They had the same instincts. They were conviction politicians who just believed that too much government was a bad idea and something should be done about it. A lot of people had thought the first idea, but they hadn't thought, what can we do about it? And both of them thought that if you rolled your sleeves up, actually, you could at least stop the ratchet effect of what both of them thought was creeping socialism, welfareism, the government getting itself involved in all sorts of matters which they thought the government should keep out of.
Thatcherism has been described as economic freedom and individual liberty being interdependent. Should we make that definition a little longer? And it would be the same definition of Reaganism.
Yeah, very similar. And it is the interesting thing about both of them and why they both actually changed the conservative movement both here and in Britain was that they took conservatism, which was well established to be a pro-business notion. You should try to protect the status quo. You believed in tradition. You liked traditional units like the family, institutions like companies, if you like. I mean, everything should be left more or less as it is, and the change should be looked at warily. They added on top of that a very broad vein of libertarianism, which meant that actually there were sort of individual rights that people should enjoy, and that the state should have nothing to say about, say, what they eat or what they smoke or whether they wore a seatbelt. They were interested in all of those sorts of libertarian issues, which, of course, since both of them ruled for so long in the 80s, have come to the fore, really, and it's now really very evident on show in the Republican Party through people like Rand Paul and his father, Ron Paul. Of course, Ron Paul, who is a Republican, but he started off, or he appeared as the presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party before he returned to the Republicans. So that both Thatcher and Reagan added this very important, as it turns out, dimension of libertarianism to what otherwise was a rather staid and stuffy political philosophy.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned conservatism, particularly in her early years, as being a male chauvinist kind of party. How in the world did this woman become the head of it?
Well, if you met her, you would understand straight away. You wouldn't even have to ask the question. She was enormously dynamic. There are people like that. In fact, I'm married to a woman like that. You know, the fact is they are always on the go. They get up before you. They go to bed after you. They are just solidly on the go. They had no downtime. She couldn't relax. She could never sit on a beach. When she was the education secretary, which was the 1970s, the first time she actually received any power in her life, I mean political power in her life, she would go on holiday, and all of the civil servants would be greatly relieved because, you know, the heat was off, the boss was going to go away for a few weeks. But then she'd come back within a week saying, well, I've done that. I couldn't get on with that, doing nothing, so I'm back in the office now. They all had to abandon their holidays and come back in and work. So she was a busy, busy person, enormously determined. And I think that also, I mean, she always said famously, what has feminism ever done for me? But actually, of course, feminism, she didn't acquire power until the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. But, of course, the feminist movement on both sides of the Atlantic had been very active before that. And so there was a sort of tide coming in where women had got over the fact they got the vote, which was from sort of 40, 50 years before. And what they were now determined to was to get to the top in all things. The fact that she chose the Conservative Party, in a way, would suggest that actually she chose the most difficult thing. But because she was so self-evidently capable, and because there were very few conservative women who dared do what she did, which is to insist upon getting to the top, in fact, it might oddly be rather easier than in the Labour Party, where there were lots of women all juggling to try to get to the top. She had a relatively clear way. I'll give her an example, though, of how Margaret Thatcher sort of anticipated everything. In the 1955 election, she was up for election, and because she was one of the rare conservative women candidates, and she was, I shouldn't say this because I know that the president got in trouble the other day, but she was a good-looking woman. You could think about, from the television point of view, she was very presentable, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She was young, and she had already a couple of children, and she looked good. And so, of course, instantly they wanted to put her in the TV commercials. And she came I was told this by the man who made the TV commercial. She arrived, and she was in a dotty dress. Now, as you remember, maybe from early TV, if you had a dotty dress or dotty clothes of any sort, it tended to strobe on the screen. It looked rather weird. And they said, I'm sorry, Margaret, you're absolutely perfect, but I'm afraid that dress won't do. And she said, you know, I thought that might be the case, so I brought another one. I mean, she was one jump ahead of everyone else. She was just a bit smarter. She was just a bit more determined than anyone else. And in politics, that really counts.
Yes, it does. Tell us a story when you were on the airplane with her and you wanted to open this champagne bottle. Coming back from Japan, it's a great story.
Well, there's an example, you see. When she became prime minister, she was exactly the same. She wouldn't go on holiday, and so they had to keep arranging foreign trips for her to get her out of the country, you know, get her something to do. So which was great for those of us who were following her, because we knew that every time the parliament wasn't sitting, that there would be a foreign trip for us to go on. We went to Japan, inevitably always. It was very funny, of course. They tried to show her robots, which broke down. She was thrilled that the Japanese robots broke down in front of her. They were ashamed, but she thought it was very funny. Anyway, by definition, every Thatcher trip was an enormous success, which meant that on the way, flying back to London, there would always be a little champagne celebration for how wonderful it had all gone. And so we were called to the front of the plane, which was, it's like Air Force One, is kitted out with all sorts of sofas and grand chairs and cocktail cabinets and so on. And there she was, opening a bottle of champagne. And I said to her, "Prime Minister, may I open that for you?" And she said, "Yes, no, Nicholas, you sit down." And she pointed to her what effectively was a throne. I mean, the Prime Minister's chair on the plane is a big chair. And I thought, I wouldn't dare do that. But I said, "One thing I am good at is opening champagne." And she said, she caught me with a sort of gimlet stare. She handed, still looking at me in the eye, she handed the bottle to someone else. And then she took me, she put a hand on either of my shoulders, and she pushed me down into her chair. And I must say, I got a shock of electricity up my spine, like I've rarely had. I always call it my Mrs. Robinson moment. You can see that there was, although she wasn't obviously, she never obviously used her sort of feminine wiles, she had a sort of electric charge to her. She had a special dimension, which was, it's very difficult to describe it. It wasn't sexual at the same time. It certainly wasn't the opposite of what sexual is. Mm-hmm. It was some that, in that sort of netherland. And she was quite happy to use it if necessary. She was surrounded by men. She actually wasn't very good at promoting women. There was only ever one woman cabinet minister. Everybody else was men always. She wasn't, it happens. Some men are not good with women, and some women aren't good with women. And she would really, she preferred to be the only queen bee. But she really upset the way that cabinet government ran. Cabinet was designed, I mean, you know, this has gone over centuries. Cabinet government designed so that even the prime minister is not really meant to be the leader of the group. It's always primus inter pares, that is, the first among equals. And yet she changed it because she wasn't prepared to put up with what men do. Men, actually, although they're the sort of common notion of men is that they're confrontational, that's not the case when it comes to politics. They shift around. They can never bring themselves to say the awkward words. They're very bad at firing people. She was not at all like that. She actually wanted people. She kept putting people on the spot. She liked a really good argument with people. All of these things, which actually men in the political class shy away from very quickly. Mm. And through that, she got her own way too. I must say, whether you're left or right, whether you're sympathetic to her or not, just purely as a political practitioner, she was astonishing.
Mm-hmm. You have written, in the case of Reagan and Thatcher, the friendship was between equals, and as a result, America, this is an amazing thing you say, was more powerfully and directly influenced by a foreign leader than any since the founding of the Republic. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think, I mean, America is quite rightly very jealous of its sovereignty and on the whole doesn't ever welcome, right from George Washington's warnings about foreign entanglements. They don't like foreigners to have anything to do with their affairs. Certainly, it's true in World War II that Churchill was welcomed warmly by Roosevelt after Pearl Harbor, and because he was part of the Allied team, and they worked very closely to each other. But Roosevelt never let Churchill forget that actually Roosevelt was the most important and powerful person in the world, and that Churchill was a supplicant. I mean, after all, Britain was almost beaten by the German forces. But in the Reagan-Thatcher case, it was very different. They met as equals. In fact, if anything, when they met, she was more likely to achieve power and did achieve power sooner than he did. And they became friendly on a sort of just one-to-one level, and that never really disappeared. They shared something in common, which is that they were both isolated in their own governments, in their own administrations. Thatcher, because she was a woman, and also because she was way to the right of the rest of them in the Conservative Party in those days, and she was trying to drag the party rightwards, and she had a lot of opposition from within her own party to that. And they used to call her names. They would call her the Blessed Margaret or the Leaderine. They would make up all sorts of sort of schoolboy things to try to get at her. Ronald Reagan was exactly the same. I spent a lot of time with the people in the Reagan administration, and they all say the same. He was, because because he was a sort of at least a half to almost a full generation older than all of them, he was very isolated, and he was considered, they refer to him as the old man. He wasn't someone you could just sort of go into the Oval Office and have a chat with. He was someone who always kept himself slightly distant. His personality was of that sort, too, by the way, which comes from having myopia, which he only discovered by accident when he put his mother's glasses on as a child. He was always rather distant. His close members of his family, Ron Reagan, young Ron Reagan, will tell you
yes.
that he never felt that he got close to his father. And this distance, however, was sort of broken down by Thatcher. She managed to sort of slip under the net, and he trusted her, like almost like no one else. Even Nancy acknowledged that actually that Margaret had a special relationship, and when they got talking, they should be left alone, which was very rare from Nancy, who really wanted to involve herself as the gatekeeper, really, to Ronald Reagan.
Well, you write about the fact that they would send notes. They'd be discussing a policy thing back and forth, but they would write little notes in the margin, you know, congratulating each other on a birthday or a wedding anniversary. They were very involved in each other's personal celebrations and lives.
That's right. It was a genuine sort of personal friendship. This wasn't invented. This wasn't a political alliance. That's why I call it a political marriage. It was a strange thing that they genuinely, they were both the sort of people who, when they'd been to something they liked, they would then send a thank you letter. Ronald Reagan was a brilliant letter writer, and so was Thatcher. So Thatcher less inspired, actually, as a writer than Reagan. But they both had those sort of basic civilities, which meant that you would ask after somebody if it was their birthday or wedding anniversary or one of those things. And that's the intimacy that they got onto. Just like, you know, many slightly old-fashioned nowadays, probably couples, who befriend each other and they share key events in their lives, Thanksgiving or whatever. You know, they may go to similar things. So you can imagine, it's fascinating, go through the Margaret Thatcher archive. By the way, you can do it all online, so it's rather wonderful.
Oh, you can? How do you do that?
Just put in Thatcher archive in Google, and then you'll find it.
Oh.
And every single public paper, and a lot of private papers too, I think it's the first political archive that I know that is entirely online. It's an astonishing thing. It's the actual hard copy papers are kept in Churchill College, Cambridge, but it's all online for us all to see. And you can see the original documents there where there are scribbled notes, you know, sort of happy birthday next Tuesday, Margaret, all that stuff. You know, I mean, it's a real glimpse into a private world which was going on in parallel to what otherwise was the largest time. You said that she was the longest prime minister in the 20th century. It was true, 11 and a half years. And Reagan, of course, had two full terms. So this is a rare thing when a president and a prime minister overlapped for the full two terms. And they knew each other before, and of course they kept up even after they lost power. So it was, it's an extraordinary thing. I can't think of anything like it. And now Thatcher, why I suggest that she's the first person since the beginning of the Republic, I just can't think of another figure from a foreign land who was really let into the absolute center of power. And her advice very often trumped the advice of other people around Reagan, including when it came to should America help, for instance, Britain liberate the Falklands, which had been invaded by Argentina. Everybody in the State Department, everybody in the ambassadorship to the United Nations of the American administration, all said no. This is a bad politics. We've got to keep the South American allies on side at all times and let the Brits sort of stew in their own juice. But because of the persistent, it's access as much as anything, Reagan would lift the phone always to Thatcher. He loved to talk to her. There's a wonderful story. Once he had a meeting in the Oval Office, which an assistant came in and said, "It's Prime Minister Thatcher on the line," and he stopped the meeting, and he took the call. And at one stage, I mean, she spoke rather like me at the moment, like a sort of Gatling gun. She was very fast and very busy. She put his hand over the receiver, and he held it up so that they could all hear this voice coming out and said, "It's Margaret. Isn't she wonderful?"
It's Margaret. Isn't she wonderful? We're talking this hour of the program with Nicholas Wapshot, and we're looking at the life of Margaret Thatcher, and particularly the relationship between Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. That's the title, A Political Marriage, is the subtitle of one of Nicholas's books. He followed her. He was senior editor at the Daily Beast and was also the New York bureau chief of the Times of London, editor of the Saturday edition of the Times of London. He was one of the first biographers of Thatcher and has written a great deal about conservative and libertarian ideology. And, of course, he knew Margaret Thatcher. We have yet to talk about Mikhail Gorbachev. And I think this is an interesting part of the relationship because she realized early on that she could work with this new kind of Soviet leader. And I'm wondering if she brought Ronald Reagan to the same opinion of Mikhail Gorbachev and if things would have gone very differently had she not thought very highly of him. And what about the very conservative policies? Both of the leaders were probably grudgingly admired, but a lot of people didn't like their policies either. And I'm interested in finding out more about how the people of Britain responded to Margaret Thatcher and some of the policies, particularly concerning labor, that were troublesome, to say the least, to many. Here's our phone number. Join us, please. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave a message for us on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and a Justice in a Time of Terror. In 1917, a bomb exploded in a Milwaukee police station, killing 9 officers and a civilian. Those who were responsible for the bombing were never apprehended, but the police, press, and public assumed that the perpetrators were Italian. Days later, 11 alleged Italian anarchists went to trial on unrelated charges involving troubles that had occurred 2 months before. Clarence Darrow is involved in an appeal of these Italians, and it's a fascinating book. Dean Strang will be our guest. He's a criminal defense lawyer in Madison and a professor at UW-Madison and also Marquette University. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation about Margaret Thatcher, we would like to hear from you, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and lines are open for you right now. Now, Tom in Burlington. Hi.
I was in Washington at the Washington Gallery of Art, and John Spencer Churchill was an artist. I wonder if you met him. But anyway, I'll tell you a little quick story about him. He was staying with Miss Holly, who was Holly's Department Stores, but she lived in Georgetown and on M Street or N Street. And all the townhouses, they all look alike. So he came home from one of the taverns, and he walked into this house and fell asleep on the couch. And the lady in the house got up the next morning, and it wasn't Miss Holly's house he was in. He was in the wrong house. But as graceful as John is, he got out of it. But I wanted to ask about the relationship between Miss Thatcher and Reagan. How much did that affect the relationship between Tony Blair and Mr. Bush? In other words, I think Tony Blair tried to imitate the friendship that they had between Bush and that relationship.
Okay, Nicholas?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You're on the right track there. I think it's true of all British prime ministers, too, by the way, certainly since Churchill, since the British Empire lost its preeminence in World War II and America has been the greatest nation on earth. It serves every British prime minister to pay attention to what the president is doing and to get as close to them as possible. There's no doubt in Britain's mind that America is Britain's closest ally. They claim to have a special relationship, which I must say Americans on the whole don't recognize because they've got other countries that also think that they're their best friends. But as far as Britain's concerned, if on the whole, whatever America says, they'll go along with. I think that Tony Blair, who was an enormous admirer of Margaret Thatcher, he was politically, of course, on the opposite party, but he understood, I think, that if you befriend an American president, then you just have more clout on the world stage. You just move up the line a bit. And certainly, he it was easy for him to befriend Bill Clinton. They thought very similarly. They both changed their parties. In the light of Reagan and Thatcher, they changed their parties to become more centrist and less progressive, if you like. And so the Clinton thing was easy. The George W. Bush was a little more forced, but at the same time, he tried to befriend him too, and there are extraordinary pictures of the Bush and Blair wandering around Camp David in identical jumpsuits and so on. I mean, they're sort of a very strange man-friend relationship going on there. Even in the very first press conference, President Bush was asked, "What do you two have in common?" And she's beaming at each other. He said, "We both use the same toothpaste," which was a particularly bizarre notion. But there's no doubt. Yeah, Blair took his cue. He watched what Thatcher was doing with Reagan, and he became a bigger figure because of it. It's almost led to his undoing, in as much as he went along with the Iraq War, which was hugely unpopular in Britain, and he has become almost a non-person in Britain today. People dislike him intensely because of his relationship, just his obedient relationship with the American president. So it did cost him a lot in the end. The Reagan-Thatcher thing seemed to work out fine. It seemed to enhance both of them, actually.
Thanks, Tom, for the call. What about the criticism that has been directed at both Thatcher and Reagan that they were a bit hard-hearted? They broke unions. They didn't seem to have much empathy for those who didn't have very much in either country, the poor. Their policies benefited those, and they had a natural alignment with those who were wealthy.
Yeah, I think what you say is absolutely true. They would hotly deny it, of course, because they would say that by introducing market reforms, eventually everybody is better off. It's the eventually problem, really. Even if what they say were to be true, the fact is that they wanted to make changes, which it's at least in the short to medium term meant withdrawing labor rights from unions. They both deliberately confronted a trade union. A principal trade union. In Britain, it was the miners' union at a time when all the mines were owned by the government, so it was almost like a government union. And in the same way, in fact, taking absolutely his cue from what Thatcher had done with the miners, Reagan set about the air traffic control people, and instead of compromising, he deliberately ensured that that union was broken. So there are dark sides to Reagan and Thatcher. I think that today, if you go to Britain or look online at the British press, it's divided right down the middle. And the people who didn't like Mrs. Thatcher despised her. They mm-hmm. hated her for what she was doing. I must say, Britain is not used to seeing the sort of scenes of violence that took place during the miners' strike, but it also took place during the poll tax riots, when the center of London was set afire by demonstrators because of what Thatcher was insisting should be done. To see armed police on horseback, all dressed up like sort of samurai warriors, beating down miners, unarmed miners and their wives and children is not a pretty sight. And for a lot of people, she will never be forgiven for doing that, for being so confrontational. So part of the drive that we've, in a way, made a lot of a light of, you know, and thought of as an admirable quality, she was also, and I think Reagan was the same, they were both actually rather narrow-visioned. It made them amazingly effective as an executive. If you've got any executive could look at Reagan and Thatcher and say, why were they successful? It was because the number of things they wanted to achieve was relatively small, and they focused entirely on that and nothing else and would not be distracted. And it proved to be amazingly effective, but very painful for the opponents who stood in their way. So it's a mixed blessing. Parliament in Britain is just about to, they've just been called back from their Easter break in order to discuss the legacy of Thatcher.
Really?
And the Labour Party leaders had to say, treat this woman with respect. There are no votes to be had in being rude or being too brutal against Mrs. Thatcher. You know, this should be a time of mourning. But there's no doubt, and I won't be at all surprised if a number of Labour MPs use it as a way of trying to assess whether all that violence against the miners was really necessary. Whether the welfare reforms, which took money away from really poor people was necessary. The whole raft of things which will come out of the woodwork and won't be very pleasant to listen to for the other side, who think of Thatcher and Reagan, to that matter, as a sort of saintly person almost, someone beyond any reproach.
Yeah.
The difference between the two of them, too, of course, was that Ronald Reagan always managed to introduce everything with a bit of a joke. He was immensely likable. And so he could sort of mollify people, having upset them. Thatcher was incapable of that. She had very little sense of humor, and although she had grace one to one or in small group, when it came to her public persona, she was very brittle, and she never ever showed a softer side to her in the public realm. And that too, I think, is going to bounce against her now that she's gone. Because people will be able to say something which they've been biting their tongues for a couple of decades now about what she did to Britain.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about the press's treatment. I think that as I look at particularly television treatment, the American press's analysis of what's going on in Britain, we still seem to love the royalty. We spend a lot of time talking about the Queen and about how wonderful Margaret Thatcher was. We're not as critical as what I expect is going on in Britain right now, that it's a much more wholehearted examination of her and probably not as lionizing in a way, or laudatory as what we may be getting.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's a very different approach altogether to public affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Here, people certainly scrap with their gloves off. I mean, the presidential race or even primaries can be really pretty brutal. But generally, Americans would prefer to think well of their leaders. In Britain, it's just they start off in a different place. They are hugely critical of anyone in a position of authority. They have been what we might call bolshie. I mean, they've been aggravated for some centuries now about the people who rule them. And they even cut one king's head off. You know, I mean, they are totally disrespectful. They give them the honeymoon of about 3 weeks, and then they resume a pretty vituperative assault upon them. And the other thing, of course, is that Britain has an extraordinary free press. We have something like 15 morning daily papers in London,
Woo!
An astonishing array. And it carves its audience up depending on the political spectrum of where exactly you are. So everybody's catering for a slightly different audience, which means that newspapers become a bit tribal. So if you're a Labour supporter, you read The Guardian or The Daily Mirror, and if you're a Tory, you read The Daily Telegraph and The Daily Mail. You can tell someone exactly
yes.
who they are by what they're reading.
Yes.
In America, that's not quite the same. First of all, you have, by now, in as much as you have any big city newspapers, they're all monopolies. They've eaten all of the other opposition alive by now. In New York, sure, we've got the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and two tabloid newspapers, too. But that's pretty rare. By now, you're down to, you know, one tabloid and one broadsheet. And they don't compete with each other because they're in different markets. That all may change, but we're getting off the track in a way. I think that critical aspect of the Brits can seem disrespectful often. I've had it myself at a dinner party when I open up about something that's going on, and people look at me shocked, as if, you know, you shouldn't say such things about the president, or you shouldn't say such things about the governor, whatever, you know. But so I think that the Brits maybe are a little more open in their dissent.
Mm-hmm. I'll bet you get invited back, though. You're probably very interesting. Let's go to Charles from Ingleside, Illinois. Hi, Charles.
Good morning. I want to ask whether or not both Thatcher and Reagan were readers of Ayn Rand. I worked with the Libertarians in 92, and we had scads of young people coming in wanting to volunteer. And it seemed like both were, if not readers, actual readers, they were followers of Rand. I wonder, too, Ron Paul named his son Ayn Paul, and that sounds very... Ayn Rand-ish also. How about
that? To take the last point first, Though I thought it would be wonderful if Ron Paul had named his son Rand after Ayn Rand, but I think his name is actually Randolph. I think Rand is just a short form. But so the obvious ideological clue there, it didn't work out. But the now it's interesting. Both Reagan and Thatcher were really conviction politicians, so they thought what they thought, which came out of their gut. It was just an instinctive assumption about how the world works. They read their philosophy backwards. That is, they read their philosophy in order, conservative philosophy, in order to endorse what they already thought. I don't think that Margaret Thatcher ever read Ayn Rand. Conservatives outside of America don't tend to read her. Reagan, I know, did, but much more important to them both, actually, was the man who I wrote a book about most recently, actually, Friedrich Hayek. Hayek was a free market, limited free market guy. He wasn't a total laissez-faireist like Ayn Rand. In fact, Ayn Rand hated Hayek and used to spit at him at parties because he thought Hayek was a compromiser. But Hayek, who is now one of the great patron saints of American conservatism, wanted a market which was efficient and worked fairly and freely, and therefore he thought that there should be limitations to the way that the market worked. And both Reagan and Thatcher thought that the Hayek model was much closer. Thatcher used to go and see, Hayek used to make an annual visit to London, and Thatcher would literally sit at his feet and listen to everything he said. And I said before, she was capable of talking the hind legs off a donkey. When Hayek was around, she was strangely silent for hour on end. So that was the change. So Hayek, people like Ludwig von Mises, they read a number of others. They were, but Rand was not at the top. Ayn Rand is actually a very difficult philosophy because it is absolutely rampant. Free market, do exactly as it likes, totally unfettered, and that leads to, and I think that beyond the teenage years when you might read The Fountainhead or something and think what a wonderful set of notions, people tend to grow out of that when they grow into the real world and realize that, you know, the law of the jungle itself is not a good place to live in, you know, under. It's best to have some sort of regulation, even if you believe in market forces.
And isn't it interesting, Nicholas, you write that Hayek, who you've also written about, I didn't know you wrote a book about him, that here both Thatcher and Reagan were reading this theorist, and it was at a time, you say, when he was long forgotten, even among conservatives. So you've got Thatcher and Reagan reading somebody who not anybody else is reading. That's an instant connection, isn't it?
It is indeed. It's an extraordinary thing. That's one of the reasons they ended up answering each other's finishing each other's sentences.
Yep.
They were absolutely on the literally the same page. You know, they had read the same stuff. One of the reasons that Reagan read so voraciously, he wasn't an obvious sort of book learner. He wasn't a great academic, but he had a fear of flying. And when he worked for General Electric, and he used to go and visit all the GE plants around the country in order to give them a little conservative pep talk with the GE management's blessing, he would read, and he actually had this serious cast of mind. He was interested in political philosophy, and so he read great lists of books that he read that are way outside even a modern conservative's ken. It's an astonishing thing. He was an autodidact, really. He taught himself a whole philosophy, which he took an instinctive interest in it, but then he learned a lot from the books.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, they both shared this, which that's another thing. They changed their parties. The Republican Party and the Conservative Party changed because Reagan and Thatcher introduced what neither party had had before, which is a clear ideology. Until then, both parties were hugely successful, but they were opportunistic. They did what they had to do. If they thought that the electorate was leaning this way, they would lean that way. They would arrange their policies. They would spot what the opponents were up to, and they would choose policies which were popular. After Reagan and Thatcher, they were coming off a sort of hymn sheet. There was a list of things which they were expected to do because people like Hayek had said that they should be doing those things. And in a way, that hampered, in the post-Reagan, post-Thatcher period, that hampered their parties because now they have this sort of checklist where, in order to get elected, in order to even compete, you have to meet various hoops. As it turns out, the sort of hoops that you have to jump through in order to be a Republican candidate now would mean that actually Reagan would never have got elected. He never would have got chosen because they are now much stricter even than when Reagan and Thatcher introduced philosophy into a party and a business, which otherwise until then had been entirely invented as it went along.
Nicholas Wapshot is our guest this hour. We're talking about Margaret Thatcher. He's written extensively about her. He knew her. He covered her when he was a journalist in England. He's author of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, A Political Marriage. We thought we would concentrate for most of the hour on that part of her life, but we're looking at other things as well. In 1983, Nicholas wrote one of the first biographies of Margaret Thatcher. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, leave a message there so we can all read it, either now or later, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We have yet to get to Mikhail Gorbachev. There's so much to talk about. I promise you we will do that in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Mark in Wausau. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Can you tell us if what religious affiliation was Mrs. Thatcher, and was she a religious person? Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
She was a religious person. She began life as a Methodist. She had a very strict Methodist upbringing. She went to chapel on a Sunday twice. She wasn't allowed to read newspapers. She wasn't allowed to go to the movies. She wasn't allowed to play records on a Sunday. In fact, interestingly, John Wesley, being the one of the great founders of the Methodist faith, when she married, shows how she moved. When she married in the late 40s to Dennis, they married at Wesley's Chapel, which is in City Road in the City of London. It's where Wesley himself preached. Hmm. However, the Conservative Party was always jokingly referred to as the Conservative Party at prayer. It was the backbone of traditional Britain, particularly rural Britain. And to be a good Conservative, you had to at least suggest that you were an Anglican. And somewhere along the line, she dropped the Methodism, and she picked up the Anglicanism, or as we would call it here, Episcopalianism. And so she went sort of respectable. Methodist was very much a sort of working class faith, and Anglicanism was an upper class faith. And so she made the move, as many people do. She was a social climber. Mm. I don't think that she would even deny that that was the case. That's what she had to do in order to get to the top of the Conservative Party. That's what they expected, you know. The Queen is the Queen is the head of the Episcopal Church in Britain, and the Queen is the head of all of the, they think anyway, the Conservative Party and all of its notions.
And what about Ronald Reagan? Would you say he was a religious person or not?
I think that he had a strong moral compass. I'm not sure. He also was brought up, his mother was a member of an almost Catholic sect. In fact, I think she was a Catholic. They were Irish Americans. The father had lapsed, but the mother stayed true to that. He was very close to his mother. And he did go to church, too. In fact, he stopped going to church when he was president because it disrupted the churches that he attended so much because of the attendant security and so on. So that's the only reason he didn't go to church as often as he should or as he felt he would want to. I have no evidence at all that they ever discussed Christianity between them. But Thatcher was, of course, even on her way into Downing Street, the very first time when she was elected in 1979, she quoted Francis of Assisi on the way in. She would quote when the Belgrano was sunk, and somebody said, "But aren't you worried about all those poor Argentine boys?" She turned round in anger. She quoted John Wesley, the beginning of a hymn, and said, "Rejoice, rejoice." So I think Thatcher, her religious upbringing always remained just below the surface. It probably was a little further below the surface with Reagan, but they both had a strong Christian morality, even if it wasn't a sort of conventional church-going faith.
All right, let's get to Gorbachev. She invites him to Britain in December of 1984. She says, "I like him. We can work together." So I'm wondering if she hadn't said that, I'm wondering if the course of the whole fall of the Soviet Union may have been different, and maybe that's overstating the case. But she obviously was influential in getting the president of the United States to entertain the thought that this is a new kind of leader. He will probably become the leader, and maybe we can work with him.
Absolutely, and I think that's that would be my exhibit A in saying that Thatcher interfered or got involved in American decision-making more than any other individual or any other foreign leader in the history of the Republic. This is absolutely a turning point. They were both sort of trying to engage the Soviet Union. Reagan would send, much to the horror of the State Department, slightly old-fashioned and slightly naive letters to each new Soviet leader saying, I wish we could, you know, be friends. Why can't we meet and talk and everything? And, of course, the Soviets, who are very hard-nosed, took no notice of this. Thatcher was, as ever, amazingly practical. When the grumpy old guys who ran the Kremlin started dropping off because they were all in their late 80s. They were dropping dead out of old age. And so they were going in quick succession. She started going to the funerals of them. And whilst she was there around the edges of the funeral, she would try to work out who the coming people were.
Uh-huh.
So it stood to reason that this top group of men who were all the same age, they would run out of these old men sooner or later, and there would have to be a new regime. And she actually came to the conclusion, she and the Foreign Office in Britain came to the conclusion, there were two people. There was Gorbachev, but there was also a man called Romanov, who was the leader of the Leningrad Communist Party. And these two were vying for it. So she did this extraordinary trick. She invited them both to London. And when Gorbachev accepted the invitation, she knew that actually he had won. He was independent. He could afford to leave the country. He was safe enough to leave the country, and it would still be there when he got back. And so Gorbachev came. She took him out to Chequers, which is the great country house, the sort of Camp David of Britain, and regally entertained him, but really prodded him. I mean, she said, the very first thing she said to him was, now I'm going to be friendly with you, but don't think for a minute that you can get between me and Mr. Reagan. I mean, it's astonishing. So she puts the electricity through him. She comes to the conclusion that actually he is someone who's ready to start dismantling the Soviet Union, which, by the way, is already crumbling. There's a myth that somehow that Reagan and Thatcher between them ended the Cold War and pulled down the Soviet Union. That's not quite as it happened. The fact was it was already crumbling. What Thatcher did by spotting Gorbachev and then instantly calling Reagan saying, this is the guy, this is the man you can do business with, is that Reagan said, invite him. So actually Reagan invited himself to the Soviet Union. I think that's how it happened in the end. But that intervention by Thatcher was pivotal in what became a negotiated dismantling of the Soviet Union and its Eastern European empire. And I think that we can give them enormous credit. I don't think that they entered this Cold War, and I don't think they brought down the Soviet Union, but what they did do was provide a very easy transfer. They helped the Russians get out of their dilemma by being charming, by being affable and friendly, and by helping them in the next steps. They became Gorbachev's best friend, and they said, how can we help you? How can we do this? And they provided lots of expertise about how to privatize, which Thatcher had done amazingly well. She privatized a dozen state-owned industries. And so she became the sort of go-to woman about how to privatize all of the state-owned industries in the Soviet Union and in the Eastern European communist countries. So, yeah, she became the model. And they worked very closely, hand-in-hand, on this very important thing. So the Cold War did come to an end. And I think that what we can thank them for is that it came to an end without a single shot being fired. It was a peaceful transformation out of one of the most disgusting totalitarian regimes that the world's ever seen.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. About a minute left. The only genuine disagreement that Reagan and Thatcher had had to do with nuclear arsenals?
Yes, Reagan was a wonderful fellow, but he was extraordinarily, I'd suggested, optimistic and naive. And do you remember the Star Wars shields that was going to protect America? He's seen that in an old movie in the 50s, an old science fiction movie, and thought it could be put into practice. It couldn't, but never mind. The fact was that he really wanted to be the person who got rid of all the nuclear weapons in the world. And he went to Reykjavik and with Gorbachev, and they tried to negotiate it away. But Gorbachev made a great error, actually, and didn't agree with just getting rid of them all. And as a result, he said, you've got to get rid of Star Wars, which didn't exist. Nobody knew that, but Reagan should have known that and just grabbed the opportunity. However, when it was all done, and Reagan came away disgusted because Gorbachev wouldn't give them all away, Thatcher instantly flew to Camp David, and they had a little ride on a golf buggy out of the hearing of their civil servants, and she just told him what. She said that mutually assured destruction has actually ensured the world's peace for the last 50 years, so don't start messing with that. And the alternative to nukes is to have very large standing armies with thousands of tanks facing each other across the sort of German-Polish border. Is that what you really want? We can't afford that anyway, Ronald. You've got it wrong. And so that was the only time, really, that she lost her rag with him. Mm. Otherwise, she mostly tried to guide his instincts in the right direction.
Yeah. You're wonderful. Come to our conversation anytime. Thank you so much for the hour.
It was a great pleasure.
Yeah, it was a pleasure for us. Nicholas Wapshop, the book that we were referencing a lot, although he's written others, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, A Political Marriage. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this highly interesting hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll return.